Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
You're listening to Justice, a podcast exploring all areas of the justice system, with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor.
As the year draws to a close and thoughts often turn to the future and new beginnings or career paths, I decided to chat to Dr. Simon Fox, who is head of law at Solent University and also associate professor of criminal justice and legal education, about what it means to actually study criminology. I myself am quite biased as I love this subject and have not one but two degrees in criminology. So I thought it would be useful to dive deeper into what this subject really is, what it's about, and where it may lead someone who chooses to study it.
My name is Dr. Simon Fox, an associate professor in criminal justice and legal education at Solent University on the south coast over here in Southampton. And I have a 25-year history in criminology, and before that in law and in policing.
So what I want to do today is to try and get to the bottom of and explore a little bit more about criminology, what it really is as a subject, how it came about. So should we start with kind of when did it emerge on the scene as an academic study? Because I know that when I studied it as an undergraduate, probably 20, 22 years ago, there weren't very many universities that offered it, actually. And it was more of a tagged on to sociology. So when did it appear on the scene?
Yes, yeah, and I like to hear the view it was tagged onto sociology, because I'm still having this debate at my university, which is Solent University, and other universities, as to where does criminology fit. And it always entertains me, because you're absolutely right. Is it within a sort of psychology department? Is it a sociology department? Is it law? And I suppose my answer to that is quite simply, well, it can be in any of those. There's a tradition, I suppose, in the more traditional universities, put it that way, what we call the Russell Group ones, you might find that it's more attached to law. And then the post sort of 1994-5 universities, you might find it more in the sort of sociological, psychological aspect. For me, criminology, its history, its background, really just came about from, and don't worry, I'm not going to give you a lecture here about you know, its history and beginnings. But if you look at it, it very much started off from people such as Cesare Lombroso looking at how and why on earth do we have these people who are not conforming, who are actually then breaking these things that we call laws. And they then try and understand it. And then you've got some sort of form of biology coming in, and you know, perhaps they're looking at phrenology and the bumps that are over people's heads and faces and things like that, trying to work out a type which could be identified, and that's a criminal, etc. So you've got all that going on. So have a look at the history of criminology by all means, but you're going to find essentially that criminology is made up of law, sociology, psychology. But then, and this is what I always say to students or anybody who's interested in criminology, actually, criminology, the study of crime, is going to deploy anything and everything it can in order to try and understand the elements of, well, what is crime? Why do people commit crime? Why are people victims of crime? Even down to, you know, why are certain locations more prone to crime? What can we do to prevent it? Is there any possibility of rehabilitation? Are you born a criminal? Can you be nurtured into a criminal? Can you be nurtured out of being a criminal? victimology, you know, the element of someone being a victim. This is always an area that has fascinated me as well, because essentially people have sometimes been a bit too coy or too scared of actually looking at why are people victims. Because what needs to be clearly understood is that we're never going to be saying, well, I certainly never would, and I'm pretty certain all my colleagues would never say, you are complicit in your own victimology, i.e. it's your fault. But what we should be doing is looking at, well, what are the conditions, what are the processes, what are the structures that have actually led to you becoming a victim? And then again, that is key. I suppose another area that is quite contemporary at the moment, but has always been there, and it's something I've always started with whenever I go in and I talk at schools or at colleges about why should you be studying criminology. And I say, listen, do you realise, and I'm sure, Edwina, you know a lot about this, look at the current prison population. Look at how many of that population are male compared to female. I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, we're looking at, again, you probably have a better idea than me at the moment, a prison population of what, 87,000, something like that?
Yeah, roughly sits around sort of 85, 87, but it might be lower at the moment, but yeah.
And again, that figure intrigues me. So how is it we're managing to maintain that consistent figure? But anyway, that's another story. And then out of that, what is the current prison population who are female? And again, I suppose we're looking at how much, Edwina?
Just under 4,000.
So if we're looking at that, what on earth are the male counterparts doing? And again, we can get into research and debates over, is it because they are more sort of criminally orientated? Is it because the society itself and the social processes and structures have actually recognised them more as criminals? You know, contentiously, and I'm only saying this absolutely with tongue in cheek here, is it something to do with women are more astute and able to get away with crime? You know, all these things are possibilities. And I suppose that is absolutely what fascinates me about criminology. If I get, you know, I've been now going in the area of criminology, and I came from law, by the way, from my sort of original discipline. If I ever get sort of perhaps bored with a particular area, so for example, I have a history of looking at human rights, which is fascinating, I can then think to myself, right, okay, I'm now going to be looking at something else. I'm actually going to be looking at, let's have a total change, an environmental factor. Why are certain environments more prone to crime than others? And then start looking at that. It's fascinating.
And it seems to me, having done 2 degrees now in criminology, that there's probably like other subjects, I don't know because I haven't studied other subjects, but there's no real hard and fast facts in a way, is there? It's sort of, as one of my assignments was, a compendium of approaches. You know, it's lots of opinions, isn't it? And then you can say, well, this is the trend in England, but that won't be the trend in India.
You've got a lot there. You've got comparative criminology, where I could say to you, right, it would be lovely if I was able to say, listen, we've got a process or a practice over here about crime prevention that works, let's say, for example, in England. So hang on a minute. Over in the United States, why don't you use the same process as a way of preventing crime? Well, the answer is, I'm afraid, it's never going to be that simple, because you're going to find that the environments, the population, the people is going to be different. The culture is going to be different. And so that's why sometimes when we come up with a view of, hey, it's simple, all we need to do is, if when we see something working over here, we can actually deploy it over there, it might not necessarily work. And that's certainly true the more you then look on an international context. So then some people will say, well, Simon, why bother with comparative criminology at all? And I say, well, the moment you accept that you need to then have a more of astute kind of consideration of the, I suppose, transference of that idea, there's still something to be had here with actually then trying to work out if it's going to work in that kind of environment. But don't forget, all of our, if you wish to use this term, societies are the product of our own history, our own sovereignty, our own environments, our own cultures. And then, of course, it gets even more complicated when we start thinking about the influence of various other sort of cultures all coming together, religious understandings as well, everyone sort of trying to work together and basically get on. And in fact, there are theories that talk about this kind of aspect. And actually, a lot of crime is born out of this sort of social transition and how things actually change. And it's interesting you saying about criminology and there being lots of ideas as to how it is, it occurs and how crime occurs. And you're absolutely right. It would be lovely if I could just come out and say, listen, I've got a really good theory. This is why people commit crime. Yeah. And there are ones, you can look at, and I'm so sorry, I'm going to sort of quote some, and please, anybody listening to this, you can have a look at these up. You've got, things like anomies, social dissonance, strain theory. You've got social bond theories, absolutely fascinating. Routine activity theories. There are so many. Labeling theories, lots and lots and lots of these theories. But guess what? They all make absolute logical sense. They have all been shown through their research foundations to actually, they do seem to actually explain, but they're very context specific. And what I would suggest to you is that if ever you want to say, right, I want to know how and why that person has committed the crime or how to stop crime, good luck. Because essentially it's like a matrices of all sorts of different theoretical possibilities.
Yeah, and then of course one person might have quite a few theories overlaid on their particular circumstance and background, right?
Absolutely. And I've had some involvement in considering after people have been convicted and gone into some form of incarceration, then at what point is it appropriate to have them released? And then we look at how should they be monitored. Now, in that, you have this two-factor aspect, which is you have what is known as a passive risk assessment and an active risk assessment. So a passive one would be looking at, well, okay, how old are they, even down to, what sex are they, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those kind of things that haven't really changed over time. And from that, believe it or not, you then start having a view as to the likelihood of them, committing a crime. But then you also have to look at the active factors so that then once they're on release, what are they doing? Where should they go? How should they act? All those different things, again, might well then lead to them perhaps at least being, I'm using this word really quite loosely, tempted to then commit crime themselves. So you're right. It is fascinating to me because you've got active and passive risk assessments going on, and these go on today, which are often conducted by various different agencies. And where do they get that understanding from? Well, they get it from normally some of these theories, but not all of these theories that, you will learn if you go off and you study criminology. And that absolutely fascinates me. And the other thing I would say is, if I really, really want to blow people's minds, I say, right, so these are all the theories as to why people might suddenly, depart from this being a lovely social animal of where we all have this perhaps you would expect normal view that we're not going to commit crime because we all want to get on with each other. Yeah, so that's kind of like a social structural theory. Okay, that's great. But hang on a minute. Let's just stop for a minute and just say to ourselves, what is it out there that actually prevents somebody from committing a crime? And by that I mean, perhaps we should actually turn this on its head and say, we all actually want to commit crime. So what are the factors that prevent us from stopping it? And that's why, again, sometimes I look at social bond theory, and I know that's something, again, that's of very much of trend, and it's used by a lot of agencies, because what they're looking at there are, well, what are the systems, processes, associations that actually tie someone to believing in their community and believing in their social environment that will actually stop them from committing a crime. And of course, that makes logical sense. And we agree with that, because the more you're invested in something, possibly the less likely you are to actually then commit that crime. But then I also take it even further. I say, that's fine. That seems logical, doesn't it? And everyone says sort of yes. And I introduce them to this thing called rational choice theory as well. That's pretty basic, where I say, well, if you are wishing to commit a crime, let's say, for example, you wish to commit a mugging of somebody, a robbery, you would look at your potential targets and you'll think to yourself, right, rationally, I can see that that person is bigger than me, so I'm not going to attack them. Okay, so that lends itself to victimology. Fascinating. Fine. Okay, but that's rational choice. I said, but what about if we now go down a more psychological route and actually say that person, and again, I'm using this term very loosely, is not rational?
Yeah, or they were jumped on and attacked from behind and you turn around and maybe punch someone and end up accidentally sort of, kill a blow by accident. You certainly wouldn't be like, that was a rational choice. It was completely irrational and completely terrifying.
What I tend to do at that point is I go back to my nurturing home, which is the law. And I would then say, fine, okay, let's if that were the circumstance, then could you, would you, what would you do? So you could claim self-defense, for example, but then we understand that, again, this is concept of reasonableness. So if someone, for example, Edwina did go to mug you, you turn around and hit them, and they unfortunately then die, well, there is this thing called the thin skull rule. You have to take your victim as you find them. Perhaps you hit them with such force and they had a particularly thin skull that they then died from that. Well, okay, very unfortunate for them. Potentially, yes, you would be in a lot of trouble, but then you would hope that a jury certainly would then see that as a reasonable use of force, and that's how it was. If, however, you were to get into an argument with somebody and push them, and they fall backwards, bang their head on the curb, and perhaps a normal skull construction would actually be such that they would be fine, but they didn't have a normal skull construction and actually it was thin, and they were to die from that injury, you would still be in a lot of trouble.
I remember working with male lifers in prison, and actually most of the male lifers that I was working with were in for exactly that. You know, some not so much, but there was a large majority who it was exactly that situation. It wasn't necessarily going out with a knife and sort of, you know, hunting down victims sort of murders. It was that really terrible set of circumstances that led to something that really shouldn't have happened. And no one went out with a premeditated idea that something like that was going to happen.
I absolutely agree, because back in my history, when I was doing my master's, I had a really fantastic opportunity to go in and talk to some people who were in Wormwood Scrubs. And I had exactly the same thought. The majority of people, I mean, obviously it could have been perhaps constructed in that I was seeing the people of who committed certain types of crimes in certain types of ways. But I can remember thinking to myself, my goodness, actually, I just see that you have just made the wrong decision, or perhaps you reacted in a certain way, which then caused you to cause that level of harm, and now you are where you are. And that, for me, almost kept me up at night, because I'm thinking, goodness, just think of it. It's that split-second decision that then has led to them, you know, being in prison. But then, of course, I then look at it even more deeply, and I think, so that split-second decision, where did that come from? How did that develop in that person? Is it something that, you know, through socialization, they have thought that that is a conditioned response that they need to do? Or is it a situation where, you know, and this is also fascinating at the moment, biologically speaking, are there people who are perhaps prone to act in certain ways because it's in their biological makeup, you know, propensity perhaps to have a inability to quite empathize or understand. Who knows? And again, fascinating.
Yeah. And I suppose then the difficulty comes if it's so difficult to work out why people do what they do, and then you sort of move further down the chain to the sort of criminal justice response to why people do what they do. How are we ever going to get that right if we can never work out why people do what they do?
Correct. Putting to one side the whole element of investigating crime, which is another area of criminology, by the way, but which fascinates me, and how the police should be dealing with it, and how then our own Crown Prosecution Service, or indeed, if you're speaking on an international front, the other prosecution services deal with it. We're then also left with the view, okay, we've now identified, prosecuted, and now convicted this person of this crime. Now what do we do with them? And this is a whole field of as you know very well, penology, where we say, well, okay, do we put them in prison because we're saying you have done a wrong, so we just want to make sure that therefore you understand that it's wrong, so we're going to make that point by making you essentially suffer, okay, to punish you, punishment theory. Are we then going to then progress from that initial punishment to then into some form of rehabilitation? Because it would be lovely and logical, again, if people went into prison and then came out not wanting to go there and not wanting to commit that crime. But sometimes the tendency seems to be people wish not to go back into, I'm using this word again, prison or incarceration, because they're scared about going into prison. Is that necessarily an effective way? And we can talk for quite some time, and again, another fascinating debate is, for example, the death penalty. will people go out where there is a jurisdiction that has the death penalty and murder somebody thinking, I'm actually not going to now shoot this person and kill them because I'm so scared that I'm actually going to myself then be put in the electric chair? Or are they thinking, okay, I understand that, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to plan so well that I'm going to get away with it? Or are they put into a circumstance where actually, again, guess what? It happens so quickly that they don't think about that at all. So does, therefore, the death penalty work as a form of prevention? Again, it's another debate. It would be lovely if we could rehabilitate. It would be lovely if we could actually spend the time with these people in prison, think of them as individuals, and give them an individual package where we actually say, right, we've now analysed you, we've looked at sort of the theoretical perspectives as to why you have a propensity to commit crime, why you committed this crime, we've got you to accept it. We can go through all sorts of different sort of rehabilitative kind of processes with them. And then they then leave and they understand that actually, no, similar circumstance happens again, I won't react like that. Or indeed, actually, I don't want to engage in that type of activity. Or indeed, I don't want to now associate with those types of people so that I then get into some sort of wish to actually, through peer pressure, perhaps also do this type of thing. The problem and concern, though, that is always going to be there is how much will that cost? How much would it cost for us to individually give a bespoke rehabilitation package to that particular person? Okay, so maybe we can't do that, but maybe we can pick out rehabilitation that actually might work for a greater group. Fine, so maybe we should do that. And then, of course, and this is where, unfortunately, then politics will get involved. Because then it's the view of, so hang on a minute, how much are we spending in prisons at the moment? How much are we spending on rehabilitation or diversionary tactics? And how much are we spending on education or healthcare? Where should the balance be? And I like to, and in fact, you know, I was telling you earlier how I wish to be apolitical in many of things, but I would say to you, it seems logical to me that if you are on a political agenda, you might be going for a populist kind of view. I.e. if it's unpopular to actually be seen to be giving money to people who have committed a crime, don't do it. Give it elsewhere. And I think that is particularly something that anybody who's interested in penology and preventing this repeat offending or recidivism, as we call it, that is something that we need to be very aware of. And of course,
yes.
You can compare it, though, with other, again, I can use this word cultures. If you go over to some of the more sort of Nordic states or other jurisdictions, they have a different view. They have a different view. But again, that's from their history and their political makeup.
And certainly from my point of view, having been sort of, you know, you can't take politics out of criminal justice, actually, can you? And you might be left, right, sort of agnostic about the whole thing, apolitical, but you can't bring yourself out of it, really, because as you say, a lot of it is throwing red meat to the sort of to the voters, and it lock them up, throw away the key. So of course, actually, in my opinion, politics really drives a great dysfunction and does us a huge disservice, really. And I don't know about you, but because I'm such a geek, I often spend my quiet moments designing my own justice system from the very start in the community and sort of what I think should be there in my sort of utopian land. And then what would the responses be at every single step of the way? And if it did get up to court, what would that court look like? Does it still need to be a gladiatorial sort of ancient thing where everyone's dressed in wigs if you're in the Crown Court and robes and they're speaking a different language? And, you know, as much as that is beautiful and wonderful to watch in many ways, it's heartbreaking and soul-destroying at the same time. And then, of course, if someone sends us to prison, it's take them down and they sort of almost go through a trapdoor in some places. And then off they go into the bowels of the court and disappear off into some unknown prison. And God knows when they're going to come out the other end, spat back out into society, usually not in a very good way. So I don't know. Are you a geek like that? Do you sort of try and design your own?
I'm an absolute geek like that. But my design, I still haven't come up with an effective one, because if I could start from the very beginning, and by that I mean I'm looking at now some sort of literally we've just progressed from the Neanderthal to the Homo sapien kind of, you know, upright sort of movement. Brilliant. And we can then start saying, fine, we're now organizing ourselves into a community here where we understand, wouldn't it be great if rather than perhaps living in our own little pockets of families or as individuals, that we all come together, because then we can actually say, right, you over there, Ugg, you're going to be now responsible for farming, and you over there, whoever you, I'm going to call you, you're going to be responsible for buildings. And actually, now we're doing this, we understand that in order for you folks to be getting on with your particular roles and jobs, we need to have some sort of rules so that we can actually now share our resources. And then the moment you start doing that, that's then going to create potential for certainly negotiation, if not conflict, because people will say, well, I need slightly more, I need slightly less. That person over there, they're not doing quite as much activity as me because of the nature of their role, so should they get so much food? So you're going to then have to have sort of rules which actually need to exist. And the moment you have rules, you're then going to have some form of process to actually enforce those rules. And that's when you would then have perhaps people who would be the guards, dare I use the word police, who actually would be there to enforce it. But then also you need a fair, or for the community, its perception of fair process, where if somebody is caught to infringe that particular rule, that then they must actually be brought in front of a tribunal, a group of people who you all accept or are learned or of notoriety in your community, who can then make a decision as to what then happens to that person. You know, and then, I dare say it, there are various different sanctions. The simplest and the one I absolutely do not advocate sanction would be, well, we get rid of them. Either we eject them from our small community and they can go out and they'll wander around in sort of, you know, the wastelands, or we kill them. And you know, again, that has happened in our history. Do we then try and create a situation where they don't want to do that again and we then put them back into society? If you're doing that, then do you go down the punishment route? Do you go down some sort of instruction route? How can you do that? And also there needs to be, and I can always remember one of my first jobs was working in a solicitor's firm quite local to where I am. And I suppose I came in with all these glorious theories of rehabilitation, et cetera, et cetera. But I always remember that the partner there said, well, Simon, you do realize that though it's also there to punish. And that, again, kind of made me go, okay, maybe, I suppose, there's something here. And again, that's why I'm interested. So we're not only looking at theories of crime, we're also looking at theories of punishment. And that's another key area in penology.
Isn't that the loss of liberty, full stop?
And again, if you go to, I had a fantastic time for all sorts of many reasons when I was on an Erasmus exchange student, and I went over to Holland and I went to Groningen, and I'm sorry, I know I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, but anyway, a lovely university, lovely environment, and I visited some of their prisons, and they absolutely have that. They say, hey, you know, we're Dutch, we're in Holland, we're just taking their liberty, and otherwise, you know, it's fine here. And they had tennis courts, swimming pools, they had lovely environments. And I just literally come from, because I was doing a comparative analysis, from the Worm and Scrubs at that time. And that was in the 1980s. You can imagine the contrast that I saw.
So obviously people will be balking sort of listening to that. And I've also been to prisons in Norway and had my own sort of self challenged by, because you can't help it when you're sort of from, you've seen the prisons in England and Wales and you sort of think, gosh, this really is very nice. Is this okay? But as you say, officers will say, well, it's the loss of liberty, full stop. And it's
absolutely
a really interesting concept. And actually, we forget that prisons are a place of employment. People should come to their work place and be able to do their work safely. They should not have to worry about escalating sort of violence and violent environments. And, you know, it's just a really interesting thing to think about. You know, the assaults and the suicides and self-harm, reoffending rates are much lower out there, aren't they? And people always say, well, you can't compare. And it's like, well, we do compare. And we have to compare.
And don't get me wrong, again, I'm literally, and I do this sometimes in the odd class now that I still teach, and I do enjoy it. I deliberately come up with contentious kind of different perspectives. And so often I'll be saying to particularly after we spent some time explaining the basic practicality behind preventing recidivism through rehabilitation, I then say, but hang on a minute, what about punishment? And then I try and again to get people to think about that and compare and contrast. So absolutely fascinating. But one of the things you just mentioned there absolutely is correct. And that is we have people who are working in these prison environments. What about, let's just use this term, their rights? What about their safety? What about our expectation of them? And we have high expectations as a society, I would suggest. I do. I expect them to work in a certain way. I expect them not only to keep them there, I also expect them to treat people ethically. I expect them to treat people well, looking after their welfare. I would be absolutely hopeful that they are engaging in some form of training so they know how to undertake rehabilitation of those people and not just, you know, turning a key in a lock. And that's my expectation. But then if you think about it, we have an awful lot of expectation of those people working in public service, and we always will. A classic one, I'm sorry, I'm just deliberately going to lead you into this one because you know it's somewhere that's close to my heart, and it's policing. We expect a huge amount of our police, and they are privy to huge amounts of criticism, but understandably. We have a situation where, again, as a society, and particularly in the United Kingdom, we have this thing called policing by consent. And what that basically is an informal kind of social contract where we said, right, I tell you what, we're going to now make you folks, the people who we appoint, in charge of coercive control over us. Okay, you can tell us what to do. However, we accept that only on the condition that you actually police us in the way that we wish to be policed. Okay, and that's the element of policing by consent. And of course, the problem comes when who actually decides that? Who actually decides how you wish to be policed? Is it based upon the general populist view? What about those who slightly disagree? And of course, that's the nonsense of it, because essentially, of course, you're going to disagree if you're going to be subject to the coercive control of a police officer at that time. The very essence of being a criminal, to use this term, is to deviate from a social, if you like to call it, norm, to be a deviant. So you've got all this going on. But it absolutely fascinates me because the police are in a very, very interesting position, because what happens there is that For our jurisdiction, to use that term, what we must be expecting is for the police to be responsive in how they police to both local and national concerns and priorities. But also, believe it or not, and this is enshrined in ex-party Blackburn, et cetera, they need to be apolitical in how they do it, okay? Because we don't want, the last thing we want are the police to be political animals saying, right, yeah, we're card-carrying members of this particular political ideology or thought. Because the next thing we have to say is, well, if you want to have a look at how that works out for you, look at Germany during the 1930s and then what happened there. It's something we have to be very, very careful. So the police must be apolitical. But then, of course, and again, I am a criminologist and I have colleagues who've written in this area. Are they truly apolitical? And then they talk about the miners' strikes and various other things sort of coming into it. And of course, we've got various different debates there. But the theory is the police must be apolitical in how they do it, but they must be responsive to both local and national processes in what they are going to be doing and how they prioritise their role. So this is why I'm also fascinated by the roles of the police and crime commissioners.
You just took the thought right out of my mind. And I was thinking, how can they be apolitical when actually now there's a police and crime commissioner who is a political appointment, who then sets the agenda for the police who should not be political?
So the way, in theory, according to what I feel, but I'm not the only person on this, it's not my theory, is that, yeah, absolutely, fantastic. So you've got the police and crime commissioner who should be very much switched into the local, regional concerns and will very much push that particular sort of agenda. They will say things, right, we need you to get out and because we've noticed that in this particular area there's a high rate of drug-related crime. Sort that out. So that becomes then the list of priorities. And indeed, they actually have financial influence as to, you know, the budget that can be given, along with sort of the Home Secretary for National Concerns. But strangely enough, still, we do have this aspect of the chief constable or the commissioner, if it's the Metropolitan Police, in theory, can turn around and say, well, actually, I have overall operational control, so you can, by all means, give me those priority areas, but how I'm going to do it, that's for me to decide, thank you very much. Now, of course, this then gets very entertaining when then we also consider, well, hang on a minute, can there a police and crime commissioner actually fire, sack a chief constable? I'm not too sure about that. And again, fascinating. Have a look at that. So this is called what's known as the tripartite policing system or structure. And it's trying to achieve this balance, which is very intriguing to me, of how you have, yeah, the police need to be representative of the people, but equally they need to be apolitical in how they do it. Going back down to the view that often the police will be there and they will be forming that, and I'm going to use this term, that thin blue line between one person's or a group of people's rights on this side and another people's group of rights on that side. And they are there to make sure, essentially, I suppose, fair play and the law is being respected in how they're doing it. And that lends us back to one of the loves of my life, and that is human rights. Again, absolutely intrigues me, because we all know that we should have human rights. Well, perhaps the majority of us think that. But, okay, what are they? Who says what is a human right? And again, we're back to this sort of more majoritarian kind of understanding and view. And what about those who are in the minority? But again, it's trying to achieve that balance, trying to set a minimum standard of conduct beneath which we're saying, no, you can't go beneath that. And that's why we have the Human Rights Act 1998 in our country, and obviously it's ratified in the rest of Europe as well. But again, intriguingly, dare I say, look at internationally and look at abroad. Look at perhaps the I know they have their Bill of Rights in the United States, but look at, you know, what they have. Do they have a Human Rights Act, for example? Go off and find out. And then look at how we will have other countries and other jurisdictions and what their history and what they currently are doing. And you think, well, okay, fine, we're okay in this country because we're quite sort of insulated, good for us. Well, that kind of works until then we get into another fascinating area for me, and that is this element of transnational, if you like, international crime. And okay, our police now need to actually prevent crime and investigate crime that is being committed by people who aren't necessarily nationals of the United Kingdom. And actually, we've got this now gross concern of organized crime, let alone terrorism, where they will be going to many different jurisdictions. And if you think about it, if I was this way inclined, and I somehow, for whatever reason, wished to run an international organized crime syndicate or gang, I would be trying to work out where the more permissive laws are or where the fallibilities in their investigative processes are. In the meantime, I would also be thinking, okay, I'm going to operate in those countries because they are not perhaps so well established in their policing investigatory powers, or perhaps their laws are more permissive. Okay, but in the meantime, we've got a situation where you would hope that our police services of each country would be talking to each other, to help each other, to deal with this international aspect of crime that crosses all borders. But of course, then we get into the effect of sovereignty, and we get into the effects of us saying, well, hang on a minute, how's that going to work? So we're going to ask for a French gendarme to come into our country to arrest somebody. I don't like the sound of that. Are we going to set up an international policing organization? And some people say, hey, that's what Interpol's about. No, it's not. Interpol is there to assist in liaison, et cetera, between police services. So how on earth are we going to deal with this element of international crime as being one of the things? And then, of course, this is before I even get started on this lovely thing, which is known as cybercrime.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, and the sort of borderless crime and technology moving on so fast, and the perpetrators of certain crimes in cyberspace, it seems sort of light years ahead of how police can ever sort of get there and then receive the training and then the resources. But I just want to sort of bring us back quickly to the academic study of criminology. And if there's any students listening and thinking, well, you know, what kind of careers can I go into if I study this, what we've discovered is intensely complicated, subject. What sort of careers does criminology help with?
Do you know, I suppose, gosh, now, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I was intrigued by this because I knew that graduates, classically, were all going into employment, graduate employment, relatively quickly. Those who studied criminology, I was thinking, well, where are they going? What are they doing? They can't all become police officers, for heaven's sake, particularly back then, because, you know, we had the cuts in the policing. But what they were doing is that they were going off, and they were going off working predominantly for these public agencies, such as offender management, such as the Home Office. Because if you think about it, everything we've just been talking about here today, all these different elements and how it all comes in and informs our understanding of criminology, these are also pertinent to certain types of career roles that are actually out there. So you've got that going on. But then you've also got then the private industries. We have quite a few of our students who have actually gone into, for example, business or banking. And then criminology is a good, strong degree. Yeah, it's a lovely degree. But then what they find is that they're soon then being streamed into anti-corruption or anti-fraud or things like that. So again, that seems to work out very well. Another area which is absolutely very much now growing is what I'm calling also the third sector. A lot of the non-profit agencies, a lot of the charities, again, they're crying out for this kind of level of knowledge and understanding. And the final thing I would say is that a lot of people now are coming in and taking a further qualification in criminology because perhaps maybe they're in the probation service or maybe in the police service, and actually they want to have a further deeper understanding of why. Why are these people who we're currently dealing with, who were called criminals, actually acting that way? And perhaps they haven't got a proper criminology degree, so they want to learn more.
And I guess if someone goes on to get masters, does that mean they can jump up the pay bands? Because actually anyone listening will be like, great, yes, I want an interesting job, but I also, you know, a prison officer gets paid, what, £23,000 a year when they sort of first join the service. So that's not really going to help with a huge amount, some people might think. So yes, would you encourage people to then go on to do the master's so that they can jump up the sort of levels within a service, or does it not quite work like that?
Well, again, it would depend upon the career and professional development of that particular organisation. But absolutely, I've seen that, and I've seen how that works for all sorts of the different sort of public agencies. There is another thing, though. And shock, horror, I know at the moment, and I know I'm particularly looking at how graduates at university, both undergraduate and postgraduate, how they then end up and we get them really prepared for going out and getting jobs of a graduate type. So I'm very much involved in that. But of course, it's not perhaps just this thing of I'm investing this amount of money and therefore expecting a career outcome, which is there. I would also say, please, this goes back to the very beginning of what I've always believed in, and that is, don't ever study any degree or undertake any form of learning unless you think you're interested in it. Because, and that's the other thing, I know I come from a somewhat older and crustier generation where things perhaps were slightly better and we used to get grants or whatever. But I went off and I ended up studying criminology because I was interested in it. And I still believe this to this day, that if you are first and foremost interested in this area, then you're going to do well in it because you'll want to read more. You'll want to understand further. You'll want to learn about all these different crazy theories about why people commit crime and how to prevent it and things like that. And then naturally you'll do well. And then naturally the better grade that you get, I would suggest, will then lead itself to actually assisting you in sort of going down any particular career. So choose wisely, choose in this case criminology because you are interested in it, and then trust me, the opportunities will open out. And that's my only other piece of advice: take every opportunity you can, because that will then lend itself to your future direction. Ultimately, for me, I would suggest that criminology is an area to be studied because yes, it does have good vocational career prospects, but also study it because, quite frankly, and I know I'm biased, look at the huge array of different interesting aspects to it that to me are absolutely compelling.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm also totally biased, obviously, having done 2 degrees in criminology now. But and I often think that actually it's relevant to anyone, no matter what career you go into, because it's fundamentally an understanding of human behaviour and what makes people do the things that they do, and sort of actually having a think about that. And I sort of hope one day in my lifetime that we actually might see a subject like this creeping into the curriculum in some way or another, sort of earlier on. Certainly you'd have to do that appropriately given the age groups, but I think it's such a fascinating, rich study of human beings, actually. And it's not all about the crimes being committed, is it? Because at the end of the day, laws are made up by human beings, and we break laws if we speed, right? So yeah, it's always the topic of a fascinating debate at dinner. Or
I can tell you again anecdotally, the amount of times I've been in sort of social situations, and it's the old thing, oh, what do you do? I'm a criminologist. And it's, ooh, and then you spend the next, probably the entire evening just talking about it. And sometimes, trust me, you know, I love that. I absolutely love it. Other times, though, when, you know, you're feeling a bit tired and you want to have a quiet life, then I will say, I don't know, I used to say I was an international dancer, but I can't kind of get away with that now. But and you're right. I think ultimately, though, if you want to really start a debate, say to somebody, okay, think about it. Crime. Why have we defined something as a crime? Is it for something that is for the social good, you know, and you already mentioned speeding, or perhaps parking in double yellow lines, and because speeding has become a more of an emotive kind of area now, and that worked extremely well to stop people from speeding. By actually advertising the effects that it has on everyone else, and it became more of a moral crime.
Links
and that's
relevant
the other thing
to this episode.
Then we
can
also have things
in
that we instinctively
below.
See as a moral
crime. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe.
Don't please don't commit murder,
also,
because
rate,
we understand
review,
that that's a naughty
all,
thing to do.
Share this
where
episode.
Does that come from?
Justice
and that,
is produced
again, we go
for
back
into
the psychology
the
and perhaps even
company.
The biology as to, well, why do some people perhaps not even conceive of it as a concern? And that's often where I start with our own students. I say, right. So what's a crime? And they come out normally with some sort of legal definition or something. I say, so, okay, we've got prohibitive, we've got moral crime. So what is a moral crime? Who decides? Morality. And then we go back to that whole debate. So, yeah, absolutely fascinating.
So I think we could probably talk for hours and hours and hours about this, and years and years and years, actually. Well, Simon, thank you so much for all your wise words. And if any people are listening that sort of want to go into a career of criminology, I think it's safe to say that both of us couldn't sort of speak more highly of it as a subject. It's great fun. And yes, endless dinner time debates forevermore.
Absolutely. And I'm always very, very willing. Obviously, if I have had some deluge of people, then I might have to reconsider. But please, if anybody's interested in criminology, in law, please, by all means, you can contact me.
Well, we'll certainly put a link to sort of where you are at the university.
Fab. That'll be fine. Thank you. And I've enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.